Eku iluna, all rise. Kenoho ne ka aha ho o kolo kolo ho o pi kue. O kaluna kana vai hano hano o Catherine G. Leonard. Ame kaluna kana vai hano hano o Clyde J. Wadsworth. Ame kaluna kana vai hano hano o Karen T. Nakasone e ho o malune. The Intermediate Court of Appeals is now in session. The Honorable Catherine G. Leonard, the Honorable Clyde J. Wadsworth, and the Honorable Karen T. Nakasone presiding. Enoho ilalo, please be seated.
Please call the case.
Case number CAAP-20-239, Kelly Waiau versus Hawaii Employees Mutual Insurance Company et al. Arguing for plaintiff appellant, Rochelle Barber. Also appearing is Laurent Remillard. Arguing for defendants appellees, Lance Au. Appearing is Stephen K. Roy. Arguing for North American capacity, Ashley Shibuya.
Good morning. Counsel, will you please make your appearances?
Good morning, Justices. Rochelle Barber and Laurent Remillard appearing on behalf of plaintiff appellants.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. I'm Stephen Roy on behalf of First Insurance Company of Hawaii.
Good morning, Your Honor. Ashley Shibuya for the National North American.
Thank you. Please be seated. Before we begin, I just want to say thank you for your supplemental briefs. We don't always do that, and I found them to be very helpful. And with that, Ms. Barber, would you like to begin?
May it please the court. The Circuit Court erred in granting the defendants' motions for summary judgment and substantive joinder on the basis that the First Insurance auto business policy excluded coverage for the subject claims brought by the Waiau parties pursuant to three employee and fellow employee exclusions. These exclusions operated to leave the assigners, in this case, uninsured for accidents which fell outside of the workers' compensation exclusivity scheme. These exclusions contravene two important public policies of the state of Hawaii. First, Hawaii's strong policy for mandatory automobile insurance coverage, and Hawaii's policy that the exception for willful and wanton misconduct to the workers' compensation exclusivity. Furthermore, as this court pointed out, the First Insurance policy contains a conflict of provisions term. That term states that in the event a conflict exists between the provisions of the insurance policy and the Hawaii Motor Vehicle Insurance laws, the Hawaii Motor Vehicle Insurance Law statutes shall take precedence over the provisions of the policy. Even in the absence of a conflict of provisions terms, this court and the Hawaii Supreme Court has long recognized that the Hawaii statutes and Hawaii law are written into insurance policies. Thus, when policy provisions conflict with Hawaii law, the statutory language must take precedence, and the offending term is voided. Pursuant to Hawaii Revised Statutes 431-10C-301, the defendants were required, or especially First Insurance, who provided the underlying automobile policy, were required to provide to the assigners an insurance policy which would operate to pay sums which the assigners were legally obligated to pay for death as a result of accidental harm which arose out of the ownership, maintenance, or use of the subject motor vehicle. Here, the assigners were co-employees of Amos Aglium, and in the underlying...
Just to clarify, yes. In the judgment in the underlying case, does it specifically say that judgment is against Frank Lawrence as a co-employee?
Your Honor, I would have to check. I am not certain of that at the moment. I would submit
but
to this...
But is that not a key fact that you're relying on here?
Yes, we are. That Frank Lawrence must be recognized as Amos's co-employee.
So right, but was that not litigated in the underlying suit?
It was litigated, Your Honor. The assigners were represented by competent counsel. They had the opportunity to file motion to dismiss and a motion for summary judgment. I believe there was a motion for summary judgment filed in the original suit between the Agliums and the Lawrences, and that summary judgment motion was never heard because prior to the hearing, the assigners decided to stipulate to liability.
Right, but in what role did they stipulate to liability? I mean, just particularly with respect to Frank, I would think that's a super key issue here. Because if he only stipulated to liability as an employer, it's a different analysis, right?
Correct. So I just want to make 3 points on that issue. First, that First Insurance asked the plaintiffs in this suit, in the declaratory action, to admit that Frank Lawrence was a co-employee of Amos Aglium. Furthermore, in the initial correspondence between the assigner's attorney, who had defended them in what I'll refer to as the bodily injury lawsuit, First Insurance addressed Frank Lawrence as Amos's co-employee. And third, most importantly, even if the court takes issue with Frank Lawrence being Amos's employer, the other assigners, Claudia, Keith, and Kevin, were certainly not Amos's employer. They were co-employees.
Okay, well, let's talk about the other assigners, not Frank, not CNF. Are they covered under the First Insurance policy in this case?
Yes, they are.
They're not named insureds, are they?
No, they are not named insureds. The policy...
Where's the coverage then?
The policy defines insureds as... Anyone else is an insured while using a covered auto you own, hire, or borrow with a reasonable belief that such insured is entitled to do so.
Okay, and but they weren't using, operating, borrowing a car or a truck in this case, were they? I thought it was Amos.
Amos was operating the vehicle, but in terms of the claims brought for maintenance of the brakes, they were certainly maintaining the vehicle.
Okay, so but I thought what you read, and I pull it up myself, but I thought what you read to me was different than that. Does it say they're an additional insured or a named insured?
No, the other Lawrences are not named insureds.
Okay.
I believe they are considered insureds pursuant to the definition of who is an insured.
Okay, so who is insured? You are an insured for any covered auto. My recollection is you and your are defined in the definitions as the person or organization shown as the named insured in the declaration part of the policy, and Frank, and I'm using his first name because their last names are all Lawrence, and I'm not trying to show any disrespect here, but Frank DBA CNF Trucking is the you or your. So, and I'm looking at part D of who is insured. So you are an insured for any cover auto. That's Frank, right?
Correct.
Okay. Two, is anyone, which is I think the language you were just pointing out, anyone else is an insured while using with your permission, a covered auto you own, hire, or borrow. So were the other Lawrence family members using a covered auto Frank DBA CNF owned, hired, or borrowed?
Yes, they were using the subject truck when they were maintaining the truck, which led to the brake failure.
Okay. Go ahead.
Recently,
Ms. Barber,
yes.
There's no dispute, is there, that Frank Lawrence was the employer of the decedent, Mr. Aglium?
Frank Lawrence, DBA CNF Trucking, was the employer of Amos Aglium. And I understand that that's certainly distinguishable from the facts in Trias, in which there was a corporation and Carl Taft was a president. However, in the underlying bodily injury suit, and even in the declaratory action, First Insurance has repeatedly referred to Frank Lawrence as a co-employee of Amos Aglium.
But he's still the employer, right?
And I understand, you know, technically looking at the definition of a sole proprietor, when they use a DBA, they cannot be legally separated. They're a single entity. But we submit it in the context of insurance coverage for willful and wanton claims. A sole proprietor should still be able to receive coverage when sued as a co-employee because, in essence, he was functioning as Carl Taft was in Trias. He wore multiple hats. He was not only the employer, but a supervisory co-employee who managed and mandated safety practices, called for others in his company to maintain the trucks, oversaw the maintenance of the trucks.
But yes. Ms. Barber, in the Trias case, Mr. Taft was not the employer. Isn't that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
That is correct.
And in Trias, there was an additional insured provision for executive officers that came into play. Isn't that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Is there any, that's why I'm asking you, who is insured? What are you relying on other than the named insured in the declaration to provide additional coverage? Because on the severability of interest argument, I think that is a key problem for you here.
And I agree. There is no such insuring provision as there was in Trias for officers of the corporation. So that is a distinction between Trias and the case here. We submit that the definition of insured covers the additional assigners, the other Lawrences, for use while they were maintaining the vehicle, which is what our claims were based upon.
Ms. Barber?
Yes.
I don't think it's in our record on appeal, but who is the workers' comp policyholder? Is it Frank individually? Is it in the lower court record?
I double-checked, they named the policyholder as CNF Trucking. The workers' compensation claims were also on appeal before this court. It was decided while this case was pending as well. And I did double-check this morning, and I believe there wasn't clarity on that. They were just referred to as CNF Trucking.
In that policy?
Yes, correct, in the HMEC policy. In Trias, the Supreme Court addressed that reckless conduct falls within the definition of accident. And very recently, within the last month, the Hawaii Supreme Court in the Hawaii Petroleum or Aloha Petroleum case again affirmed that recklessness falls within the definition of accident, calling for coverage under subject insurance policies. In the underlying suit, the Aglium family asserted that the assigners, Frank Lawrence, Claudia, Kevin, and Frank Lawrence, were reckless and willful and wanton in their maintenance of the subject vehicle, which led to Amos's accident as a result of brake failure. The Hawaii Supreme Court and the legislature have articulated a public policy in favor of coverage for willful and wanton claims. Now, in Iddings, the court made clear that willful and wanton claims are something or require something more than negligence. However, they also clarified later in Trias and Aloha Petroleum that even though there's something more, it's still an accident. It's not intended or expected conduct.
Yeah, I don't recall that the insurers are arguing that this isn't a willful wanton case. I think what they're arguing is that the policy exclusions 3, 4, and 5 knock it out anyway.
Well, I believe they argue that what the plaintiffs are seeking is a duplicate coverage or duplicate benefits that have already been paid for by workers' compensation claims. But in any event, they are arguing, you're correct, that the exclusions apply so that Frank and the other assigners are not insured for these claims. And the plaintiff appellants here are arguing that those exclusions must be held invalid and unenforceable because they conflict with the Hawaii Supreme Court and our legislature's strong policy and preference for mandatory insurance coverage on automobiles and for willful and wanton claims to escape the workers' compensation exclusivity. In Iddings, the court stated that allowing co-employee suits would provide for a safer workplace and would discourage such conduct. And such is the case here, that providing for coverage would discourage willful and wanton misconduct and would also serve to meet Hawaii's strong preference and policy for mandatory insurance coverage. In this case, the assigners, although the plaintiffs were adverse to them in the underlying bodily injury suit, had a reasonable expectation for coverage, and the public policy is to benefit insureds. They should not be left uninsured.
Right, but our starting place is the policy language, right?
Correct.
So in order for us to get to that policy argument you're making, I think we really should move to your argument about the exclusions not applying. I think that's what we need to understand. And if we do agree with you, then under Hawaii law, what is the remedy?
Certainly. So while I understand this court is likely struggling with finding Frank Lawrence as a co-employee and not the employer, the three exclusions, two addressed basically Amos being an employee of the insured, which is Frank Lawrence, and one exclusion, which was specifically the fellow employee, is what I believe the defendants argue apply to Claudia, Kevin, and Keith Lawrence. So setting aside the employer issue and focusing on the fellow employee exclusion, certainly the exclusion states what it states. However, Hawaii courts have recognized that even when a policy does not explicitly provide for coverage, the policy is read certainly in the light of Hawaii law, Hawaii public policy, and the reasonable expectation of the insureds. Here, the assigners, certainly Kevin, Claudia, were not Amos's employer, but involved in the company, involved in running CNF. They were supervisory co-employees. CNF and the assigners purchased both workers' compensation and automobile insurance coverage, thinking they'd be covered for claims that fell outside of workers' compensation exclusivity. That was the purpose of purchasing nearly $5 million in insurance coverage. They thought that when legally valid claims were brought against them for an accident, which they didn't intend to happen, they would be covered. They had a reasonable expectation. And even when such is not present in the actual policy, the Hawaii Supreme Court has honored that reasonable expectation and found for coverage for insureds. And if the court has no questions at this time, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
That's fine. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
On behalf of First Insurance, we've taken a very narrow approach in explaining our position. And our position with respect to the oral argument today is that basically the First Insurance exclusion should be upheld unless it's in violation of statutory inhibitions or in violation of public policy. And we did cite the Coffin case as an example of citing several cases where the Hawaii Supreme Court is upheld insurance company exclusions.
Okay, hold on. Let's talk about the Coffin case. That's the budget rent-a-card versus Coffin.
Correct.
But I thought what the Supreme Court held in Coffin was that budget rent-a-car was within its rights to have a permissive use restriction. In other words, you can't drive the car up here. I thought that the Supreme Court explicitly said we're not reaching the insurance coverage issue. And that's actually in the appellant's supplemental brief, that point.
For that part of the case, that is 100% correct. I agree with you. But for the part of the case where we quoted in our supplemental brief, where it discussed the same section as we're dealing with today, with HRS 431-10C-301, provisions A and B, it did discuss for the same reasons that that conflict of provision section of the FICO policy doesn't apply, and basically that there is no requirement for the insurance companies to always provide insurance in every situation for every single case. And I think that's clear for that section, for what I quoted, the direct language from the case.
Mr. L, let's focus on the language of the statute for a moment.
Sure.
Because if the first insurance policy is read to exclude coverage in this case, how does it provide, quote, insurance to pay on behalf of the owner sums which the owner or operator may legally be obligated to pay for injury or death which arise out of the ownership, operation, maintenance, or use of the motor vehicle?
That's a very astute question, Your Honor, and I
appreciate that, but I didn't really see an answer in the briefing, and I'm hoping you can explain specifically with respect to this language in the statute.
Sure.
How the exclusion doesn't violate the plain language of the statute.
I was actually planning to discuss that later on, but I'll address that point right now. So, if you're looking at a statute that we call basically an sort of insuring, saying you need to provide insurance for an insured, that is clear. FICO did provide insurance for the company, but they also have a right to provide an exclusion and say on these certain situations, that policy doesn't apply. And that's the distinction that we are trying to make for the court, is that not only have one side in saying if you qualify for the insuring provision, you get insurance, that's there. But then there's certain exclusions that aren't covered, and those are the situations that do it. And we believe that this goes to that issue of public policy, that the whole reason you allow insurance companies to have these exclusions is because if you have to insure for every situation, and insurance applies in every single case, then the price of insurance skyrockets because you're now covering everything. You're not cutting out a small slice.
But Mr. Au, isn't this case evidence of the contrary? Because the workers' comp coverage clearly doesn't apply to a willful, wanton, reckless claim against a co-employee. So it's a huge gap between workers' comp coverage and the auto coverage, right?
Yeah, well, let me explain how we got here, and then I can explain an answer to that question.
Okay.
So this lawsuit began in the very beginning with a workers' comp. That's lawsuit one. They made workers' comp. They recovered workers' comp. There is an admission that was made that they recovered workers' comp. So that's lawsuit number one. Lawsuit number two is you have the Aglion going ahead and now suing what we call the tortfeasors, you know, the different Lawrence family members and CNK or CNT trucking. So that's the second lawsuit. So they actually went after the people who are wrong. They settled with them. So the plaintiff appellants in this case settled with them, did an assignment, and saying, okay, we're just going to go after the insurance companies. So they basically made their bed on how they wanted to proceed forward with
but
getting
they
recovered.
They did tender to you in that tort case, in the wrongful death case, correct?
Did they tender to the insurance company?
Yeah, well,
in that case, I believe that there was an actual denial that was already issued.
Okay, but tendered the defense. They asked you to defend them in that suit.
I believe that the tender was denied based on there was no coverage based on exclusion in the policy.
Right. So, yeah. And then they did do discovery in that case before they entered into the stipulation as liability. At that point, they had no insurance coverage for their defense, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. Okay.
So we have a different opinion with the court on whether they're left without anything because there is no insurance coverage. They had an option to get the workers' comp, which they did. They had an option to go after the tortfeasors and collect from them, and they made a settlement. I don't know how much they collected or whatnot. That's not in the record. But then they went ahead and took the assignment to make and create this lawsuit. That's why this question is not a normal case, because this whole case was fabricated by the plaintiffs to make this third lawsuit for the deck action for bad faith against insurance companies, and that's kind of how we got here today.
Oh, so, go ahead.
Mr. I just want to return, though, to the plain language of the statute again to see if I understand correctly what you're arguing. So it sounded to me like you're arguing that because First Insurance provided insurance, it complied with the statute, even though it excluded coverage. Is that your argument?
That's our argument. The argument is they provided insurance for like 95% of the situations that would happen.
But for this situation.
For this situation, it's in the 5% of the exclusions that may apply, and it's not covered. So
would it be fair to say then that there was a 5% violation of the statute?
We're saying in that situation, when an exclusion applies, that should be upheld, and there is no coverage.
That does conflict with the plain language of the statute, doesn't it?
We disagree that there's any conflict, because the whole reason that, and I'm going to the public policy part of what I started off with. The public policy part of this is that if you don't allow exclusions, insurance rates are going to jack up across the board. And they're already dealing with this issue with like Lahaina fires with those issues.
Is this really an issue of not allowing exclusions? We're talking about whether this particular exclusion is applied the way that the insurers have applied it violates the statute. We're not talking about eliminating exclusions, are we? We're talking about the application of this exclusion and whether or not it violates the plain language of the statute. That's not really as broad an issue as you're making it, is it?
I have to apologize because I don't think my point is real clear. That if you're going to say that this insuring provision in the statute always needs to be qualified and always needs to provide insurance, then basically you are getting rid of all exclusion in all insurance policies being made because they have to provide insurance irrespective of any exclusion that's in the policy. And so it's going contrary to established law in Hawaii and Hawaii Supreme Court cases that's saying that if you have an exclusion and it doesn't violate a statutory inhibition or it doesn't violate public policy, it should be enforced.
Can't there be an exclusion that is written consistent with the statute, like how Maryland had it in that Wilson case that was cited in somebody's supplemental brief?
So we believe that this conversation and how the court is looking at it based upon and saying that you have to provide the insurance, it is getting rid of all exclusion. And that's what we tried to present to the court.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. O.
Good morning, Your Honors. Ashley Shibuya for Defendant Appellee North American Capacity Insurance Company. So as with the other insured defendants, we respectfully are requesting that this court, of course, affirm the circuit court's orders and judgments that there is no genuine issue of material fact that the otherwise unambiguous exclusions in the First Insurance Business Auto Policy are enforceable and do not violate Hawaii's motor vehicle insurance laws or the public policy that's embodied therein. Second, First Insurance's severability of interest provision doesn't preclude application of the exclusions as previously touched on, and North American, of course, didn't breach any purported duty to its alleged insureds because it acted reasonably and in accordance with the policy and Hawaii law. So first, Your Honors, application of the exclusions is entirely appropriate and consistent with the Hawaii Motor Vehicle Statute, HRS 431-10C-301, particularly in the context of North American's true excess policy, which I would add is not governed by Hawaii's motor vehicle insurance statutes. But in any case, you know, there's no dispute that the statute lays out the coverages an auto policy is supposed to have. But what we notably don't see in the statute is any prohibition against liability coverage exclusions or a mandate that said insurance must cover any possible victim of an automobile accident or that every victim is entitled to the 2040 liability limits. So
who's insured here?
I'm sorry?
Who is insured? We got into a discussion with Ms. Barber, and I guess I'm asking about your policy to some extent, but you are relying on the provisions in First Insurance's policy as well.
Correct.
So do you agree with Ms. Barber's position that the rest of the Lawrence family is insured under these policies?
I would say that they're trying to get insurance as employees under the policy. So that's how they're claiming insured status.
But do you think that the policy language covers them as co-employees, that language that Ms. Barber pointed to in the policy of who is insured?
I don't have the policy language right in front of me at this moment, but I would generally submit that under liability policies, employees of the insured are generally considered insured within the scope of their employment.
Wouldn't that have to be in the policy?
Yes.
Okay.
So going back to the statute, Your Honors, without any express prohibition or requirement, we have to look at whether the exclusions themselves violate the public policy embodied by the statute. And in this case, the purpose of Hawaii's motor vehicle insurance statutes was to create a system of reparations for those injured in motor vehicle accidents and to put limitations on tort liability in order to lower premiums and stabilize the cost of insurance. And the employer and co-employee exclusions are entirely consistent with that purpose because even though these provisions preclude coverage, they are premised on the understanding that an injured employee can receive adequate compensation through workers' compensation. And this then allows insurers to keep the price of insurance down by maintaining this separation of coverages.
Let's go back to the statutory language.
Sure.
So we're talking about 431-10C-301, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So it doesn't talk about exclusions, but it does say an insurance policy covering a motor vehicle shall provide, right? Mm-hmm. So in other words, the statute, do you agree that the statute creates a duty for someone who writes a motor vehicle insurance policy to provide what follows that?
Yes, provide liability coverage.
Okay, so that's right. So the insurance policy under this statute has to provide at least minimum. Is there anything that says in this statute that says at least the minimum of X unless you include an exclusion?
No, there's no express language carving that out, but I would submit, Your Honor, that, you know, it says it has to provide liability coverage, which it does, the FICO policy and then the other policies. And then you look at, okay, what else?
But it effectively doesn't in this situation, right?
I'm sorry?
I said, it based on the insurer's interpretations of the exclusions, there is effectively no insurance provided in this situation, right?
In this situation, yes. But I would also go back to Mr. Al's argument that if we want to so strictly construe the statute in that sense, what's the practical effect of that is going to be eliminating all exclusions in an automobile liability policy.
Right. But our starting place is the language of the statute.
Or can you help us understand how your reading of the exclusion can be consistent with the actual language of the statute apart from public policy considerations?
Yes, because the exclusions, the policy itself does provide liability insurance, and that is consistent with the statute. As I read the statute, there is no prohibition against exclusions.
Right, but there is a requirement. Okay, so let's go back to the statute, because we agreed that there's a shall provide premise under the statute. And part two said, and we'll skip the PIP because that's not what we're talking about, insurance to pay on behalf of the owner or any operator, I'll go dot, 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 sums which the owner or operator may be legally obligated to pay for injury or death, dot, 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 which arise out of the ownership, operation, maintenance, or use of the motor vehicle. Okay, so here we do have a situation where the owner, Frank, DBA, CNF, Trucking, has been adjudicated to be legally obligated to pay for an injury or death, right? And it arises out of the ownership, operation, maintenance, or use of the motor vehicle. So to me, the statute clearly requires coverage. So what I think Judge Wadsworth is trying to get to is how do we get to consistency with something that wipes that out?
I would say that you have to, there's nothing in the statute that says that we have to provide liability coverage for every and all instance. In this, you know, the broad liability coverage is provided by the motor vehicle insurance policy. And that's, you know, that doesn't contravene what's in the statute itself. And then there's no, I would say there's no prohibition against providing exclusions in the policy. And so without that prohibition, you know, arguably is there may be an ambiguity, which then we look to the public policy underlying the statute.
In your view, would it at some point, if the exclusions completely denied coverage in every instance, would that comply with the statute?
No, because then you're providing illusory coverage.
Okay. So at what point do we cross over from exclusions that are okay under the statute to exclusions that violate the statute?
Because then you look to the public policy underlying the statute, and what is the public policy there? It's to provide a system of reparations, but also to limit the cost of insurance itself.
But at what point would the, you know, exclusions, you agree that at some point, if the exclusions deny coverage in enough instances, that would violate the statute. Is that right?
If the exclusions deny coverage in all instances, then yeah, it would create illusory coverage because you're not even providing liability coverage to begin with.
So there must be some point at which the exclusions violate the statute.
Yes, and I would submit that that's governed by the public policy underlying the statute. That's how you determine whether it's permissible or not. Because there is no express prohibition against an insurer limiting its liability.
But there is...
there is an express mandate to provide at least X. So you keep speaking to what's not there as opposed to what is there, right? I mean, that's the part we're struggling with.
I don't read the statute as requiring insurance coverage in every single instance of a motor vehicle insurance, a motor vehicle accident. I read the statute as saying this is what you need to provide, and if you meet that, you know, you can have exclusions limiting your liability as long as it doesn't violate the actual letter of the statute. Because the statute doesn't require us to provide unlimited liability coverage in every single instance. And in any case, Your Honors, this motor vehicle statute, it doesn't apply to North Americans. True excess policy. The motor vehicle statutes, while they apply to auto policies, the North American policy incorporates the language of the FICO exclusions, but it's not governed by the motor vehicle insurance statutes themselves.
Yeah, but you're relying on your summary judgment motion, and virtually all your arguments on appeal are relying on the language in First Insurance's business auto what coverage.
Correct, because policy. The contract, the policy incorporates that language. So North American can look to that language to exclude coverage under its policy.
Right, but I think, and I agree with you, by the way, it doesn't directly apply to you. The problem is that if we void the exclusions for First Insurance, that would apply to you as well.
I would argue that it wouldn't, because it's applying a separate statutory consideration.
You argued that in your briefs?
No, Your Honor, sorry. But in discussing this, I believe that it's a separate statutory consideration.
Even though you're relying on the same provisions that are in the FICO policy?
Yes, we're relying on the same coverages, but as a matter of contract, you know, we incorporate it into our policy, which is not governed by the motor vehicle insurance statutes.
Did you raise that argument on summary judgment?
I don't believe we raised it expressly, Your Honor.
So probably that's not something we would rely on here to affirm your summary judgment. I mean, I'm not saying you'd, I don't know, is it waived? Maybe I'll ask Ms. Barber that.
I would say that it's not waived, because we did rely on, you know, the basics of contract interpretation and interpreting insurance policies. And so that's just a basic premise. You know, you look to the contract language, and that's what the contract language says. And so,
were you planning to get to the issue of the remedy that was briefed in the supplemental briefs?
If the statute is
right, if the court determines that the policy violates the statute, what the appropriate remedy is? And I guess I just wanted to specifically ask you whether there is any Hawaii authority for the argument that's made by the insurers that the court should essentially set the amount of insurance at $20,000.
I don't believe our brief cited any Hawaii cases, but I do believe that the appropriate remedy would be to limit it to the 2040 liability limits, because that's what the statute requires, and that's the extent of the purported violation.
Although that's just the floor that the statute requires, right?
Correct. But when you look at the contract between the parties, one, they didn't even bargain for coverage in this instance because of the plain and unambiguous language of the statutes. But to the extent that there is a violation and there's supposed to be coverage, you know, the insureds shouldn't be given a windfall when they didn't pay for this type of coverage.
But they paid for more than $20,000 in coverage.
They paid for more than $20,000 in coverage, but not for coverage in the circumstances that we have here, where we have claims by an employee.
Okay, but we do have Hawaii Supreme Court cases that in the past have voided policy provisions that conflicted with other parts of insurance law, correct?
Yes.
Do you want to distinguish those cases?
I don't have any in mind at this moment. I'm drawing a blank, but I would just say that to the extent that this court is to enforce the contract between the parties, to enforce the statute itself,
okay, so
all that's been bargained for is the 2040.
DeMello, Cowell, and Melvin Abreu, Caberto, those cases, does that ring a bell with you? Those cases all voided policy provisions on the grounds that they conflicted with what was required under the statute.
But I don't recall them requiring that the limit be paid.
No, they didn't get to that. They voided it, right? Mm-hmm.
Right. But it's only to the extent that you're imposing the statute. The statute only requires the 2040 floor. And so if that's the extent to which the policy violates the statute, then I don't see how you can require the insurer to pay more than what was bargained for.
It's the exclusion that would violate the statute, not the whole policy.
So right.
It would just be the exclusion that would be gone.
The exclusion, to the extent that it violates the required mandate for providing 2040 liability coverage. That would be my position.
But we asked about the remedy because we didn't find any cases where an appellate court in Hawaii rewrote a policy. What we saw was cases where the Supreme Court voided the policy provision. I mean, in order for us to do what you're suggesting as a remedy, if we get to that point, we would have to rewrite the policy and include language that's not in there.
I would argue the opposite, that you'd be rewriting the policy if you totally voided out the exclusion.
But you do recognize that the Supreme Court has done it on multiple occasions.
Right, but if we're looking at, you know, the rules of construction and how we apply these things, I would argue that you want to take the lightest touch to the contract as possible, and that would be just voiding it to the extent of the statute, to the extent of what the statute actually requires.
Right, and that's why we're asking, do you have authority for us in Hawaii? Whereas we're, you know, like I said, looking for guidance from the Supreme Court.
Yeah, I don't have any cases, you know, on hand. I'd be happy to supplementally, you know, brief the issue for the court, but not on hand. And so, Your Honor, just lastly, regarding the issue of the other claims, the extra contractual claims against North American, you know, without trying to belabor the point, the circuit court was correct when it granted summary judgment on behalf of North American, because it just did what it's allowed to do as a true excess policy with respect to the duty to defend. You know, the North American policy makes clear that it doesn't impose a duty to defend. The contractual language is only with respect to the duty to indemnify. So the claim, those claims must fail in that regard. The Hawaii Supreme Court also recognized in the Nautilus case that when an insured holds a true excess policy, the insured has only bargained for excess insurance. So there's no immediate duty from the insurer to drop down and undertake the defense. Also, what I think is notable is that a true excess policy can look to the underlying policies that it's specifically written over to disclaim coverage. And that's what it did in this case. And so in terms of the extra contractual claims, there's, you know, summary judgment was appropriate because all North American did was what it's permitted to do under Hawaii law and the policy. And so there can't be any bad faith because it acted reasonably.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Do you have any other questions?
I don't. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Ms. Barber, this is your time, but I would ask you to address the last point made by North American, which is they don't have a duty to defend. I want to be clear. You're not alleging that either of the excess carriers owed a duty to the assigners to defend in the first instance. Isn't that correct?
Your Honor, I believe we briefly addressed other jurisdictions in which, in situations like this, where the underlying insurance refused to defend, the courts held the excess carriers then had a duty to defend.
But everything under Hawaii law?
No, Your Honor. And therefore, for purposes of today, you know, we will look
today's
to
the day.
Yes, just address their duty to indemnify. Thus, if this court decides that the exclusions conflict with Hawaii law and public policy, the appropriate remedy is to just invalidate the exclusions, leaving the remainder of the policy intact. And that's what we've seen the Hawaii Supreme Court do, although they don't expressly address policy limits. When a provision conflicts with Hawaii statutory law, they invalidate the provision, and they hold that the policyholder is entitled to benefits. We've never seen the court say, well, since this provision operates against public policy, we're only going to invalidate it to the extent that the statute requires the 2040 coverage. That's never been done in Hawaii.
Did any of those uninsured or underinsured motorist cases address policy limits versus required minimums at all, even in passing?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I believe that, you know, when we look to the Holdings, Coberto, Dawes, they just state that, you know, once the exclusion was addressed, the policyholder was entitled to the coverage pursuant to the policy. Addressing, you know, something the excess insurer said, I believe that the defendants have conceded that Kevin, Claudia, and Keith Lawrence are insureds under the policy. And the reason that we're here today addressing the exclusions is because they are insureds. And if they were not covered by the policy in the first place, they wouldn't have to implement the exclusions.
So you want to tell us where they conceded?
Oh, I believe the counsel for North American Capacity, when she was speaking here, agreed that the employees were insured under the policy. And I'll also note that between the first insurance policy and the North American Capacity insurance policy is a General Star insurance policy. I don't believe that they have submitted a brief on a supplemental brief, and they are not here today. And thus, you know, speaking to what Your Honor asked North American and stated that she would ask me, I do agree that they have waived arguments that the excess insurer is, you know, not bound or they have any additional arguments that were not addressed in their briefs. I believe that their argument was simply because the exclusions apply in the first insurance policy, we're off the hook. We don't have a duty to indemnify. Appellants argue that should the court find that the exclusions are invalid and unenforceable, the first insurance policy applies, provides coverage to the assigners. First insurance had a duty to defend and indemnify. And pursuant to the judgment issued in this case, the excess policies also had a duty to indemnify. Once those exclusions are unenforceable and the rest of the policy is left intact, then the coverages and policy limits are available to the assigners.
So you said pursuant to the judgment, what judgment are we talking about?
In the bodily injury lawsuit between Aglium's and the assigners, a stipulated judgment was filed in the amount
of... Right, but the excess carriers were not parties to that suit, correct?
They were not, and neither was First Insurance. However, they were all put on notice. They were all invited We corresponded.
Right. They were invited to defend either as, you know, as arguably required under First Insurance, or I guess the excess carriers can step in. I think they have the right to, but not the duty to under the terms of their policy.
Correct.
But there's no judgment against them in the underlying case.
Correct.
It says they had to do that.
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. You know, we... appellants argue that the judgment is evidence of the bad faith committed by all of the insurers in this case, that they allowed their insureds to be subject to a $2.6 million judgment. However, addressing remedy, there was only a summary judgment order granted. And thus, should the court find that the policy exclusions are invalid and unenforceable, this case should go back and be remanded to the circuit court so that litigation can occur on whether there was any bad faith. And certainly appellants recognize that simply the failure to pay does not constitute bad faith.
Okay, so I think I understand your bad faith argument against First Insurance, but maybe you could lay out to me how bad faith could be implicated against the excess carriers here, where they don't have a duty to defend under their policy. It's pretty black and white, and I think you haven't actually argued against that. But how do you get to bad faith as to the excess carriers?
The excess carriers, questions of fact as to bad faith exist at this point as to whether they engaged in bad faith on the basis that the First Insurance policy is capped, or the limit is $300,000. A cursory review of the lawsuit and the claims of the Aglium estate and his dependents show that a wrongful death action could certainly subject their insureds to damages much higher than $300,000. Mr. Aglium was a young man in his 40s, working full-time, and thus the...
They had no duty to defend, right?
That is correct.
Okay, so liability isn't implicated until First Insurance pays, as far as I can tell. And that, rightly or wrongly, didn't happen. So I'm still not quite following you.
Sure. So the excess insurers were notified of this claim before it went to binding arbitration on the issue of damages.
At least, in fact, North American, right?
I'm sorry?
At least North American. There was an argument that not everyone was notified.
Oh, and we dispute that. You know, we believe General Star was notified. And in fact, the excess insurers asked us at one point to postpone arbitration so that they could investigate the claim. And, you know, whether or not that investigation met their duties, given that the initial policy was so low to protect their insured, that is a question of fact that the circuit court should examine. And we've conducted no discovery at this point. The motion for summary judgment was granted very early on, and we submit that simply based on the Ralston case that went before the Supreme Court, the insurers have not met their burden on foreclosing any possibility that the plaintiff appellants could prove bad faith on behalf of all insurers.
Yeah, I'm just trying to understand, what is the theory or authority for bad faith on excess insurers when the underlying business auto policy insurer wasn't or didn't have to pay? Couldn't an excess yet, right? Because couldn't the excess just sit back and say, okay, well, I'll pay under my policy after X amount is paid first? How can that possibly be bad faith?
Because all insurers, whether excess or primary, owe a duty of good faith to their insureds. The assigners purchased this plan of, in essence, $5 million of insurance, understanding there's only $300,000 from First Insurance, then $1 million, and then $4 million above that. And they were looking for $5 million in coverage on automobiles, with the understanding they operate a trucking business and accidents and such, warranting up to $5 million could happen. Thus, their excess insurers owed them a duty, even when First Insurance denied, to possibly come in under the right circumstances.
A duty to do what?
Indemnify, or at least investigate the claims. And I apologize, Your Honor, that the case is escape. The case name is escaping me. Plaintiffs have cited it to their brief. There is a Hawaii Supreme Court case, I think, somewhat touches on this when they allowed the excess insurer to bring a claim against the primary insurer. In that case, the excess insurer, primary insurer denied insurance or denied indemnity, refused to settle the case. And I apologize, I don't believe they had died indemnity. I believe they refused to settle the case within policy limits. The case went to trial and then exposed the excess coverage. And the court recognized that the excess coverage carrier had a claim or could potentially bring claims against the underlying carrier had it settled, had it tried to engage in settlement negotiations with the plaintiff in that case.
Was that a claim for bad faith?
I don't believe it was a claim for bad faith. However, I believe that the Supreme Court recognized that excess carriers can become involved in the underlying litigation when the primary carrier has potentially mishandled, misevaluated, or wrongfully refused to settle the claim.
But there's a difference between permissibly being allowed to get into a case versus a duty so clear that you can be brought, you know, to court for bad faith for not doing so. I mean, that's the what. So what is the authority you have for a bad faith claim against the excess carriers? Where the underlying policy, where the primary policy hasn't paid yet.
Your Honor, we concede we have no authority outside of best place and simply an insurer's duty to act in good faith towards its insured, to protect its insured from a judgment outside of the policy limits. And in this case, it was abundantly or should have been abundantly clear to the excess carriers that a wrongful death claim on behalf of an estate for a 40-something-year-old man and his young dependents would easily exceed the $300,000 policy.
I mean, ultimately, all you have to show, right, is that there is an issue of fact as to whether there was bad faith, right?
Yes, and so we're simply asking not to decide today whether or not the excess carriers engaged in bad faith, but only to remand because that wasn't explored. There was no discovery. We believe we've met our burden of pleading that the excess carriers owed a duty to good faith, and we believe they breached it, and we should have been allowed to engage in discovery as to the communications, the conduct, what was considered by the excess policyholders.
So the payment on the workers' comp to Mr. Aglam's estate, that would not offset some of the amounts due to the plaintiffs?
Pursuant to our workers' compensation statutes, it would be subject to reimbursement or subrogation. So we would repay that amount.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Judge Wadsworth, anything more?
No, thank you.
Jackson. Okay. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement.
Eku iluna, all rise. Thank you.